Hey, this is Jen Johans at FilmIntuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. Welcome, everyone. We're back with part two of our ongoing series devoted to physical media releases from the Criterion Collection that came out this year so far in 2025. To kick things off today, I have authors S.A. Cosby and Jordan Harper. S.A. Cosby is the award-winning, best-selling author of such novels as Blacktop Wasteland, Razorblade Tears, All the Sinners Bleed, and the brand new King of Ashes. And Jordan Harper is the Edgar-winning novelist of She Rides Shotgun, Everybody Knows, The Last King of California, and he's also a producer and screenwriter in Hollywood.
Well, I'm joined by two of my favorite guys, two of the best crime writers working today, S.A. Cosby and Jordan Harper. Thank you so much for doing this. How are you both?
Happy to be here. Good to see y'all.
Very good to see you.
Glad to see you both.
Yeah.
I realize I don't know if Sean knew this, but I think this is, or had thought about this. I think this is the first podcast Sean and I have ever done together. So.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Well, it feels wrong, but it seems like we should have done it before, but
yeah.
Here we are.
Well, I am honored to be the first to have you both. Now, everybody's going to be clamoring. We better let Blake know he's got to snap you up before. I'm sure your bookings are going to go immediately. So that's wonderful. And I know that there's a new release of The Grifters from Criterion. It's awesome. And I pitched, you know, that I got this disc sent to me by Criterion. It's a movie I love. I saw around the early 90s, and it was one of my brother's friends who loaned it to me. And as soon as I finished it, I sat down and wrote my first feature-length script, a con man movie, because I was so impressed. So I know you guys love this film. And Jordan, you just saw it live, right? With Annette Bening.
Yeah, in Noir City just finished up its film festival here, and they did a great series of female-centered noir this year, but particularly female-centered neo-noir with amazing guests. I went with Travis Woods last weekend. We saw Bound with Jennifer Tilly. I got to see Destroyer with Karin Kusama. And then also they had a 35mm print of The Grifters, and Annette Bening came out afterwards and talked. So it was amazing. And just to pivot, and then, I mean, I want to hear what Sean's is too, but I really think this might be the movie that is why I'm really into crime fiction.
Wow.
Because, you know, I read like sleazy crime novels like 357 Vigilante and stuff like that when I was a kid. And I loved crime movies, like The Godfather and stuff like that. But, seeing this movie, and then going and finding the book, The Grifters, and reading it was probably my introduction to noir fiction. I can't imagine anything in the canon that we would really call noir that I encountered before this, and I just loved it. I just loved it to death. So this movie is really special to me.
What's your relationship to it, Sean?
So I was a big fan of noir fiction growing up. I've told the story 100 times. My mom went to yard sales, and she'd pick up books by Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald. And there's a certain sort of elegance to that kind of noir. It's, you know, it's post-war, it's moody, it's everything the noir is supposed to be. But in many ways, it didn't reflect my experiences growing up in, you know, in a rural town in the South. And so when The Grifters came out, I went to our local art house gallery. That's the only place showing it. It was another bad S.A. Cosby date, because I took someone that did not like the movie, did not get into it. And much like Jordan, after I saw the movie, I went and searched out Jim Thompson's books. And Jim Thompson, reading Jim Thompson, if you're a crime writer, it's akin to, you know, going to a underground fight club and holding your own. It's that he's the most unique voice in noir. And he took noir out of sort of this high-minded existential ideal and brought it right down to the gutter where it belongs. And so by the time you get to the end of the movie, The Grifters, and you see that scene with John Cusack and Angelica Houston, and anybody who's seen the movie knows the scene I'm talking about, you realize we're in a place where depravity is just another con.
It really is. Oh my God. And it's, I mean, a film and a book, of course, that is so important to so many writers. And when I was talking to Megan Abbott, I can't even remember what we were on about. She referenced how it feels like you're seeing more violence than you are. And it feels very violent. Like one of the scenes that will haunt me for life, and her, she's like, it's one of the worst things ever, is the oranges scene with Angelica Houston. And you feel like you've seen the entire afternoon go by, or the entire thing. And it's just, it is so chilling. So what they're able to do with Spare Dialogue and it in the direction of this kind of, it's a good marriage of the Jim Thompson, I feel like, because you can get Jim Thompson wrong pretty easily on the screen.
I mean, I think, you know, you might say they've gotten it wrong more than they've gotten it right.
Yeah.
I will say that I have come around on After Dark, My Sweet, in large part due to the commentary track by Travis Woods, which is one of the all-time great commentary tracks. But I do think that, you know, this is pulp and it's lurid, and you can fall into that very easily and it can feel unreal. You know, for all the noir trappings that this film has, those kind of throwback nods to noir proper, it is that psychological realism that I think really just draws it out and makes it feel so real. And again, not that there weren't real psychological depths to, like, The Postman Always Rings Twice or what have you, but, like, you know, to really get into, like, you could say the gutter, but also just the subconscious, when you're literally dealing with Oedipus here. You're literally with, like, these, like, a man who has, ran away from his mother and then picked up a woman who looks just like her. And, you know, the classic thing that, I mean, probably still happens today, but I think was much more common then, of the being raised with your mother, but being told she's your sister. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these, like, these deep psychological connections. And then, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot, about, like, you know, different definitions of noir. And one of them, I think, has to be about, like, the libidinal confluence of money and sex, that I just don't think you're really going to name a real noir that doesn't have both of those driving it in some way, that there's going to be a real money issue and there's going to be a real sex issue, and those things are going to come together. And this is, they couldn't be more than your mother's literally coming to rob you and offers to have sex with you in order to make the deal go down. It's a pretty, pretty nakedly, putting both of those things, in play. So it's a tremendous story. It is my favorite, Jim Thompson novel. I can't say, it's often the case for me, the first thing I encounter becomes my favorite, and this was the first. So, you know, I don't know if I could defend it in court, but, you know, it is my favorite, I'm ranting here, but I tried to do a completionist run on Jim Thompson last year, and I have learned about myself that I am not a completionist. there are people, including our friends, who will sit down and read, Jim Thompson wrote 34 novels, I'm going to read 34 novels. And I read 4 or 5, and then I hit the alcoholics, and that just put me off it for a good long time. But he is amazing. Everything Sean said is true, that it is... there's a nastiness and an honesty that makes stuff like The Postman Always Rings Twice feel tame somehow.
Yeah.
And that is, I think, what makes him so exciting and why he is, I think, you know, the king in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I think for me, the movie, you know, I'm fascinated with identity. I'm fascinated with who we are in public and private and who we are at our core. And for me, The Grifters is one of those movies that asks that question and you don't like the answer, you know, because what if you're a nasty person? What if you're a terrible person? And Lily is an awful person, you know, but so is her son. So it's everybody around them. There are no good guys in The Grifters, as is the case in most noir. But there's this sort of rotten darkness at the heart of the grifters that you don't see, like George saying in The Postman Always Rings Twice, or even modern neo-noirs like The Last Seduction, I think is probably the closest any movie has come to sort of radiating that same sort of caustic sexuality and like I said, darkness and perversion that the grifters had. But even The Last Seduction sort of has an out because Peter Berg's character is not a bad guy. He gets seduced, obviously, by the name of the title. The Grifters is just, these are people who are, you know, human beings at their most primeval. And, you know, and you can't stop watching it. You can't look away. I love the thing about The Grifters, just a cinematography thing. It's so brightly lit in every scene. It's, there's not this sort of shadowy sort of confluence of
humanity. Even in the bar.
Yeah, it's so light and so bright. It's like Stephen Frears was saying to the cinematographer, I want to show everything. I don't want anybody to have the luxury of a shadow. And that to me is like fascinating when you see a movie like this.
I think that is very true. It has all, like I said earlier, those like nods to neo-noir, but it doesn't feel the need to like cloak it in shadows until that last scene, which really is done in pools of light and pools of shadow. In order to just like kind of underscore how dark it all is. You know, Stephen Frears is an interesting case because he made two of my very favorite movies of that era. And I don't know that I ever knew that who Stephen Frears was until much later in my life. The fact that he directed Dangerous Liaisons and The Grifters, because they have no, he didn't have an auteur stamp the way a lot of people did back then. And so I think, you know, those guys who are just like Curtis Hanson, people like that who just come and deliver, oftentimes I think get short shrift compared to guys who just have ticks that are easily recognizable. And so they get all the praise sometimes.
I think he's one of our filmmakers who's directed the most actors to Academy Award nominations.
Wow.
Yeah, he is one of my all-time favorites. I mean, like even going back further than this, like and further than Dangerous Liaisons, of course, like My Beautiful Andrette, I think is a masterpiece. So yeah, he knows how to get the performances out, and he works so well with these actors. Of course, Cusack, he wound up becoming a big Frears guy and brought him in for High Fidelity as well. So he's versatile, but yeah, he's very interested in the psychology of people, and he loves people, which you kind of have to love even these, you know, these scoundrels essentially. But you guys said something interesting when you're talking about Oedipus and the Greek tragedy of it all, because Sean, was it Dennis Lehane that you were quoting? I'm going to let you know the quote.
Yeah. So Lehane has this beautiful quote that, you know, literary fiction is, you know, it's the idea of Icarus flying toward the sun and falling to the earth. He said, noir fiction is people on the sidewalk falling in the gutter. And sort of that, that sort of delineation between what we want to call, I don't want to say high art, but the pretension of high art versus realistic and humanistic stories. And I think that's true. I think that's the definition I carry in my own work from time to time. And, I am fascinated with the idea of the Greek or Roman tragedy, the flawed hero, or just, you know, even the Shakespearean tragedy where like a play like Titus Andronicus where everybody's getting murdered and, you know, and somebody's eating somebody's kids' hands and like, you know, cause nothing says high drama like cannibalism, but, I think there is something in the Grifters that is akin to that sort of Greek and Roman and Shakespearean tragedy where, you know, again, I just keep coming back to this idea that it's humanity, on its worst display. But it's also, I think, interesting about Jim Thompson is he comes at it from a place of great personal tragedy. You know, you know anything about Jim Thompson's life. He had a really hard life. His father was alcoholic. He himself was an alcoholic. You know, there's an urban legend that his dad like killed himself by eating the stuffing out of a mattress. And so there's a whole bunch of psychological, ball of worms there that nobody, you know, that I think he was really working through in his work, you know. And to Jordan's point, you know, you don't have to be a Jim Thompson completist. I think there's five or six really amazing novels And then there's some stuff he was doing just to pay the bills. And so, yeah. You know, there's a, you know, he's got a novel about a dwarf assassin, a little person assassin, which is one of the weirdest, most surreal things I've ever read. But then he has a novel, like it's a throwaway novel, a lot of people don't know, called Hell of a Woman, which has one of the best, most experimental endings in fiction, where the main character is becomes schizophrenic. Yep. And so there's two pages in, he's talking to himself. And I think he was just such an interesting guy, and he approached writing in such an interesting way. And of course, you know, that's why Hollywood loves his stuff. I personally think The Grifters is the best adaptation of his work. My favorite book by him is The Killer Inside Me, but that's such a difficult film to sort of get right. But I watched The Grifters in anticipation of us talking, and you know, it's not a bad performance in that movie.
No,
everybody's bringing it. You know, Annette Bening and Cusack, and even the character actor, and his name escapes me, who plays Bobo Justice, which I love that name.
Bobo Justice is a truly great name. It's Stephen Tobolowsky.
Pat Hingle is Bobo Justice.
Pat Hingle Stephen Tobolowsky or whatever his name is.
Yes, from Sneakers. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from a million things.
Oh, of course.
He's so great. And, the guy who manages the hotel, the dotty misogynist who runs the hotel is so great. And, no, he's great. And Sean's right about, you know, when I think about Jim Thompson's experimental stuff, I think about Savage Night, which is, similarly, you know, he waits until the end of the book where I guess he feels like they've already paid for it, you know, so I can go nuts here at the end. And it's another one where you just, you know, you're reading a noir novel and then all of a sudden you're in a David Lynch kind of situation for the last like 30 or 40 pages. It's really, really remarkable. I mean, there's so many different directions we could go here, because I do think, you know, talking about like just the essential nature of noir, the more I think about it, and you talk about Greek tragedies, Roman tragedies, that there is something very specifically American about noir. And I realize that noir exists other places, but America is its home. And I think the places that aren't America that can do it are places that have been infected by the American disease. And, France, Japan.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, these places that have, you know, these kind of, these images, and obviously capitalism and industrialized capitalism is a huge part of noir. You don't get noir until you have city streets and people walking and people, not just that, but there has to be the hint, not just of money, but of wealth that is supposed to be yours, but isn't. And I think that is, and again, you know, the thing about Greek tragedies where that was the gods getting you. But it's very important that noir at least look at the world from the idea of a godless point of view. And that, you know, the lie that America tells you, and a lie that's so deep that everybody believes it from one way to another, is, you know, the law of the jungle is the law, that it is dog eat dog, that everybody's in it for themselves. And it is the failure of people to succeed, or alternatively, in other types of noir, like The Last Seduction, the ability of somebody to succeed because they are ruthless and cold and compelling. Like, those are the things that you are told in this world matter. And I think those are the things that trigger off noir. And again, Jim Thompson has his finger on that always. It's always like right there. And again, you're talking about a woman who comes to her son to commit like two out of the three, you know, primal taboos. Cause she does not attempt to eat her son, which would be the third one. And just to tack over, because I there's so many different things we could talk about. Like, again, like I really quickly just underscore that Annette Bening is insanely good in this
movie. Oh my God. Yes. Absolutely. Yet another performance where it's like, she didn't win an Oscar, but she, she was nominated. She's amazing. This was a crowded year. Of course, it's the same year of Goodfellas, Godfather 3. And I love what you were saying, you know, city streets and stuff. But of course, I'm a Western person. So there's a lot of noir and Western. I think Christa Faust had a comment recently about the Italian movie Bitter Rice or agri-noir, essentially. So you can have noir, like Naked Spur, all these things, as long as there's greed in the hearts. And like you guys are saying, these are hearts of darkness. And these women are incredible. I think, is this the best? I mean, I know Sean and I talked about Pritzi's Honor too, but is this the best Angelica Houston performance? Maybe.
I think it comes in, it's almost a tie. It's almost a tie because what she's doing different in Pritzi's Honor is a very controlled internal performance, right? She's holding it in. She loves Jack Nicholson's character and she's biding her time. She's not as weak as she appears in Pritzi's Honor. In The Grifters, it's so primal. It's so animalistic. You know, she walks like a panther through rooms. You know, she's a predator, but she's a predator in a world where there are always bigger sharks. And so she's both trying to consume metaphorically, but also trying not to be consumed. You know, that great scene with the oranges is her at her, you would think she's afraid in that scene, but she's not scared. And I know that sounds like oxymoron.
She's resigned to it.
Yeah. Yep. She's resigned to it. I got to take my lumps, but I can do it. I can take it. I can keep going. And I think it's an amazing performance in a career full of amazing performances. But I think this is, and then maybe you're convincing me because maybe I feel like it is a little bit better than Pritzi's Honor just because of the physicality she brings to the role, but also the emotional depth she brings to the role.
And I
think that's fascinating. And I just want to touch on something that Jordan said.
And I
do believe a noir starts in America. You know, it starts with Chandler and McDonald and Dashiell Hammett and these folks that came back from the war who had been to Europe, who had seen, you know, the worst of humanity and came back and were pathologically determined to succeed. You know, I'm going to be a part of this capitalist environment. And then finding out that, you know, it's a little club and they don't want you as a member. And so I think that's the thing that drives noir is that drive. I'm going to get in that club. And whether it's in cities, whether it's in Westerns, wherever it is, it still comes down to this idea of I deserve this. I want this. I need this emotional security. And then, you know, you can't get it. It's forever out of your reach. And I think that's the interesting thing about The Grifters, because at the end of the movie, and again, spoiler alert, she gets the money that she needs, but at what cost, you know?
Both inspired me and you both had these genius ideas. And I love how you brought up Postman Always Rings Twice, Jordan, and you brought up Jack Nicholson and you said something really brilliant too, Jordan, earlier when you were saying how many people were raised by their sisters or their mothers, but thought they were the sister because Jack Nicholson was. So that's just interesting. That was her most important partner, of course, from this time period, romantically, and the co-star in Pritzi's Honor. But anyway, I'm sure Jordan has a million places he wants to go with this.
I mean, you know, first of all, you guys are leaving out the Addams Family when you're discussing. I'm not really joking about that. I think that is a tremendous performance.
Oh my God, she is.
I mean,
sexy, horny, great. Yeah.
Her and Raul Julia. In those two God. Movies,
oh yeah.
Such an insane.
Yeah.
Like we didn't know how good we had it back then.
No, not at all.
We really didn't. But no, she's tremendous in The Grifters. It's, you know, the oranges scene is great, but the one where she, and I was worried in the theater that people were going to start laughing is after she is, and again, we're on spoilers, after she's killed John Cusack and she starts doing what you can only describe as keening, where she's doing those full body like things. It's so powerful. The other thing, you know, going all the way back to the start of this conversation where Jen said, you know, she was inspired to write a con artist movie. And I've always been fascinated with con artists, probably a good deal. Well, it started with the Great Brain books, if you guys are familiar with the Great Brain books.
Yeah.
I loved those when I was a kid. But the thing that The Grifters does that hardly any of them do is treat con artists as being a little bit smarter than everybody else. You know, something like The Sting, which is a good movie, but like most con artist movies kind of present them as like infallible genius chess masters. You know, this is the stuff that John Cusack does is dumb. It's just dumb.
Oh my gosh, yes.
The way that, as somebody who worked on The Mentalist and spent a lot of time researching this stuff and bought a lot of magic books, and I will tell you, when you're watching a magic trick and you think of the dumbest thing that would be so unimpressive if that's how they did it, that's how they did it. Every time, it is always the dumbest. They go, well, obviously I'm not using marked cards, blah, 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 blah. They're using marked cards. Like, it's just, it is just about lying to you in a way that gets past that really, and that doesn't, like, obviously people can have skills and things like that, but it's really just a con is a brute force trick that you just kind of throw some stuff on. And, you know, the fact that they do the whole, go back to the big con is the great nonfiction, you know, book about this, where everybody draws their lingo from. And, they show the blow off in this, where Annette Bening employs what is called in the trade a tackle bladder. And it's just kind of treated as like a funny way that you can rip people off. And that is usually the end of a con artist movie. It's the end of The Sting, right? It's oh my God, they fooled them with the big blow off. And Jim Thompson sort of refuses to be impressed by these people in the way that I think most of us, including me at points when I was writing Mentalist or whatever, are always tempted to, because I think we like to, you like to think about smart people in almost a superhero kind of way, where you can imagine yourself getting, feeling superior because you're smart and you resonate with that.
That's a good point.
And I really like that this movie makes, I mean, from the very, he pulls off the trick with the $20 bill, which is a film invention in the book. He does what's called Changing the 20s, which you can also see in Paper Moon, which is a complicated way of getting more change back.
Getting change.
But if you've seen Paper Moon, you know, it's actually a pretty difficult thing for the audience to follow. And so this was just the switching the bills is a stand in for that. But I really do like that they're just presented. I mean, what Angelica Houston does is just brute forcing mathematical problems by throwing some money at long shots. And that Benning does the long con stuff. But again, it's impressive, but it's not that impressive. And what he does is just, I mean, they're grifters. It's like a grifter is not a compliment. Like, it never was a compliment. And I think Jim Thompson understands that. Even if you do like them all, you like John Cusack a lot in this movie.
I just want to jump on that real quick. I think the thing that Jim Thompson says or does in his work is the idea that you can't con an honest man, right? You have to appeal to humanity's greed for a con to work a lot of times, right? But at the same time, there's this idea, and I feel it from his work, is that he doesn't respect con artists. Because, you're playing on somebody's greed. A lot of times, though, you're playing on people's greed that don't have a lot of money. You know, the reason they're greedy is because they're poor. The reason they're greedy is because they've been knocked down a peg and they want financial security. And there's this sort of really cool moral indictment in The Grifters that you don't see in other con artist movies. I love con artist movies, too. You know, I love, you know, I'm a big fan of, you know, Mammoth's early work before he lost his mind. And and reading. I used to read The Great Brain, too, man. The Great Brain and The Three Investigators. They were my favorite.
But, oh, I love Lisa, Bill, and Jed.
But, you know, there's this idea in Thompson's work that, yeah, these guys are a little bit smarter. They're a little bit clever. But ultimately, he doesn't have respect for them. And so because he doesn't have respect for them, he's not afraid to take them to their ultimate end, which is, but he does this thing, a trick of his own, where it goes from being a moral indictment to a moral investigation. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fascinating.
One thing before I let Jordan go, because he has an obligation later, is I want to know about the setting, about the California of it all, because I love that. It's sunshine noir. So Jordan, go ahead, jump on whatever you'd like, but I definitely want to talk about the setting too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I will just to follow up what Sean is saying. I do think like that old con artist, saw of you can't cheat an honest man is not actually, that's like when the mafia says they have a code. Like it's something that people tell themselves in order to kind of justify what they're doing. But I think we all know somebody who's been ripped off by a con artist today, and it's elderly people responding to texts and not realizing that they're being catfished. Like, that's not greed. You know what I mean? And those are what actual con artists are. But I, you know, as far as the LA-ness of it, I think that it's not an in-your-face LA movie. I think, I was mentioning earlier the Noir City movies. I also saw Destroyer again, which is a movie I've seen several times. And it had never realized how much of an LA movie it was until this watching. I think The Grifters is, it's an LA as a backdrop. So it's, you know, it's not playing on any kind of essential LA-ness other than the ability to, they treat going to La Jolla like they're just bopping down the street. I've never been to La Jolla. La Jolla is like a track. But it does make for a terrific setting. And I do think that, you know, that sunshine noir, it allows Annette Bening, and Angelica Houston to wear very short skirts. I think an element of it. But other than that, I think that they do really kind of, it's a terrific background, and it's a backdrop of the novel as well.
Oh, okay.
It's
been a while since I read that.
It really works as, and I think they talk about it in the novel. It plays a big part in that LA, because it's not one big city. It's a megapolis. It's actually a bunch of villages. He is able to move around inside the city, whereas most grifters are told to change cities all the time.
He
figures out that by living in LA, I can have an apartment, and the thing where he has the matchbook salesman job is something that a normal grifter wouldn't do because they would have to keep moving to not get caught. But his theory is I can just keep moving through LA because it is this giant eternal place.
That's great.
That being said, I love you both. I do have to bop.
Well, thank you.
All right,
you
man. Good seeing you, brother.
Good seeing you, Jordan.
You bet. See y'all soon.
Yes. Later. I'll get your closing thoughts then, Sean, too.
Okay. Yeah. So I think the thing that strikes me about The Grifters, and I love all the Jim Thompson adaptations. I really do. I think the Casey Affleck, The Killer Inside Me is better than people remember. I watched it recently. I love After Dark, My Sweet, but I do agree with Jordan. Travis Wood's commentary on that is remarkable. It's amazing. If you guys haven't heard that, seek it out. It's an incredible piece of work, but the movie itself also is amazing, and we've talked about that on here before. But for me, The Grifters is the best Jim Thompson adaptation because it's the one that shies away from Jim's fatalistic sort of attitude and ideas the least. It embraces the Jim Thompson-ness of the book and sort of is able to translate that to the screen in a way that is unsentimental. And, you know, if you watch, I'll use After Dark, My Sweet, there's a sentimentality there, especially toward the end. There really is,
like with the kid and the way it goes. Yeah.
That's not prevalent in The Grifters.
No. Ice cold. Yep, just chilling. Yes.
Yeah, and so I guess my final thoughts on it is, I think if you're a fan of noir, if you call yourself a fan of noir films, do yourself a favor and seek this movie out. Watch it. It's probably Angelica Houston's best performance. It may not be Annette Bening's best performance, but it's the one I remember the most. And John Cusack he's amazing in it. Every performance is pitch perfect. It feels like an older film than it is. It was made in 1990, but it feels like something from that sort of American zoetrope period of the 70s. Like I said, it's beautifully shot. Cinematography is amazing. Very sparse, like you were saying, Jen, cold score. It's a shot of bourbon, you know, in downtown LA when the sun's coming through early in the morning and, makes your bloodshot eyes, kind of blink. And so I think you can't go wrong watching it.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you so much for doing this. And again, I apologize to anyone listening if they heard the phone. My internet's out at home, so I'm using the internet at the wonderful Poison Pen Bookstore, and it is a business, so I'm sneaking in the back and listening to the phone ring. But thank you so much, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us. Y'all take care.
You too. I am so thrilled to have one of my favorite people with me today, a cinephile, just one of the coolest people that I met on Twitter back when that site was working. Good friend, amazing driver, brilliant,
thank you,
knowledgeable film essayist, historian, writer, critic, whatever you want to call Priscilla.
God damn.
She is the Jill of many trades, essentially, instead of the jack of all trades. So, Priscilla, how are you doing?
I am doing okay. I don't know if I can live up to that introduction, but but I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I figure
thank
usually
you.
I just call you like my fellow, you know, brunette with bangs, fellow dad, essentially.
Yes, dads.
We are the dads of Twitter, the hot dads, essentially. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, whatever your dad's like, if they're not jerks, I guess, give them our number. I don't know. But we will probably have better taste than they do, is what I'm saying. But we like all that stuff. Priscilla's just the coolest person I met on Twitter. Now she's over at Blue Sky as well. She is also on Instagram, posts occasionally. And just getting back from the beach where she read some good books. She had bodacious beach hair. yes. So what did you read? Anything good?
Oh, shit. What did I read? I read the first Parker book, The Hunter.
Okay.
I actually read a book about night moves in preparation for this.
My God.
Yes. I know. I'm sorry. I've overprepared.
I love it.
And what else did I, what was the third thing? I read half of Ross McDonald's The Zebra Striped Hearse. And that was, it's just, I don't know. I just feel like noir at the beach is like what I was going for as a, as a mood.
Especially, we've got some great LA noir with night moves. When I received these from Criterion, I just knew immediately who I wanted to ask right away for Thief and Night Moves, and that was you, of course, because, you know, it's cool. Everybody loves these movies that's a critic, and I feel like these movies have maybe gotten more popular as the years have gone by, but it's always awesome when you meet a fellow woman who loves these films as much as you do, and that is Priscilla, of course. She's written amazing things on these films. She's put up stills on social media about them with her thoughts. So I was really eager to have you on to talk about them.
Do you wrote a beautiful essay about Thief's Diner Scene, which is,
I think
that's for both of us, maybe our favorite scenes of all time. I don't want to speak for you, but okay.
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely one of my favorites. I know it's the favorite scene that James Caan ever did as an actor, and his performance he's proudest of. And you know, I was going to ask you if you wanted to go chronologically, but maybe we should just dive into Thief first.
Okay, whatever works. I actually think they're oddly complementary.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
They're both like macho neo-noir. I mean, macho in different ways. I would actually say that Frank is a little bit more masculine, whereas Mosby is kind of trying to be macho.
Yes.
But yeah, I feel like they're both kind of, it's a nice pair.
It is. It's different shades of masculinity, which, I find Mosby to be a really interesting specimen. You know, we're just going to go back and forth, I think, between these films. But what's cool about the, and oh my gosh, it was bittersweet to rewatch with Gene Hackman,
who I know
is one of our favorites. Love Gene. And I also love James Caan. After we lost James Caan for DVD Netflix, I wrote kind of an in memoriam piece, and it was about Thief, essentially. It was like my first, I've written about Thief maybe way too many times, but it was before I wrote specifically about the diner scene. But I think what's interesting about Night Moves is, and Gene Hackman had said that, something about getting in touch with his feminine side was the way he approached masculinity. And I think that is maybe more of Mosby, which is curious because he was a football player. And then You have a very, I am Joe, the boss of my own body. You've got James Caan doing this very masculine. I got this new chick, you know, I love his whole vibe in that movie. But he's also very vulnerable, like in that diner sequence, which I love.
Yeah, I mean, I think in both movies, their treatment of men and women are so interesting. And in that diner scene specifically, I feel like it's really, James Caan is actively trying to be soft. And yes. It's almost like a, you know, I have a lot of thoughts about diners. I feel like they're kind of a sanctuary, yeah. And the booth becomes almost a confessional booth. But yes. Jesse, Tuesday Weld's character, by contrast, is trying to be tough. Mm-hmm. So the roles are switched in that scene, which I find really beautiful. But they're both being very open.
Yeah, because when it starts in that bar, it's very caveman. He like carries her out.
Basically it drags her out by
terrifying.
Her hair.
And some men do try to intervene because, oh my God, if I saw a man like carrying a woman, well, I don't know. I would be beat up very quickly. But, you know, if I was like a big guy, I might try to intervene or something. And it's interesting as that scene continues on and the things that he confesses to, he's also one of those guys who, you know, waits to speak, and you see him, fighting against that urge. Yeah. Yeah, like she's trying to say, you know, you're not my first con. I've been with one before, and he's just like, big asshole. Like, you know, most guys want to say any man that was with this woman before is the wrong guy, obviously. The other thing I love that I rewatched about half of this. I was telling Priscilla off air, I've been working so much that I didn't have time to rewatch the entire thing before our recording this time, but I've seen it 8 million times.
Oh yeah.
And when I got to the scene with Okla at the prison and he's talking about it, he's like, well, I got to put it back together. Like, he had a wife that didn't work and he's got to put it back together. And that's kind of the thing where after somebody breaks up or like a relationship ends or a divorce happens, they just dive in head first. A lot of times men will get remarried very, very quickly or move in with someone very fast. It happened to a few of the men in my family, like within a year, and some of my friends. And so I found it really interesting. Like, well, I failed at that. That was that. We're putting it together. We're doing something different. So he's trying to be proactive. But then when he listens to her and then has to respond and has to get deeper and more vulnerable, it is interesting because his confidence and his bravado starts to kind of melt away.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I feel like the confidence isn't there from the beginning, which is why is so it's so desperate.
Yeah,
yeah, and then well, I should preface this by saying that something that I read in Bilga's recent interview with Michael Mann, mm-hmm. where he talks about how he thought of Frank as a wild child archetype, where it's like mm-hmm. he's sort of almost feral because
yes. you know,
he talks about how he spent so much time in prison, but he's even in the system before that, like as a teenager.
Yes.
He didn't have a teenagehood, as Mann describes it. So he's going by a script, you know, he doesn't really know how to behave. So half of it is stuff that he thinks he should want, but the other half of it is just him not knowing how to talk to a woman, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Like, you have to wonder if he's ever spoken to women before he got out of prison. and he doesn't know how to be on a date. Although it somehow results in something really kind of wonderful. Like, I wish first dates. Well, it's not a first date. They've actually been dating for a few months, if I recall correctly. I want to say they've been dating for like 4 months.
You know,
I think she says, or he says
to me, he had not laid a hand on her. He had not. So I actually kind of looked at it like this was the beginning of any kind of thing.
The relationship.
Really.
Okay. Yeah. So they've known each other through the diner, maybe for that long, or the restaurant where she works.
It's vague. Yeah. Okay. It's very confusing. I think a lot of people can look into that a few different ways. I was kind of on one that was like that, where started out like a normal, let's go to a movie, and it ended up at a diner where just like bared his soul and told me things that were like, holy shit.
It's what the diner does to people, man.
I think it's a diner thing, you know, because yes, growing up in the 90s, we would go to the movie, get out late, go to a diner, talk all night about the movie and whatever thing. I mean, I wasn't really a party person, and I was a nerd who went to movies and diners. And I think there's something really intimate about a diner. Tuesday Weld is incredible in this movie. They all are. But I love what you were saying, Priscilla, about how, you know, he doesn't know how to talk to a woman or interact. And I love that scene with Okla where he's like asking him advice almost. Do I bullshit her? Like, what do I do?
Yeah, do I lie?
Yes. Yes.
And Okla has to be like, do not lie
yes.
to a person you love.
Yeah.
Which I think is actually, I love that scene too.
Yes.
But yeah, what was, oh, you know, there's just something, I think the diner brings that out in people because it's like the one place you can be where they don't bother you. You
yeah.
know, you don't have somebody trying to get you out of the restaurant or something. Like you, it's 24 hours, so there's no rush and you can just be there unbothered. I know you know about this, but people might not know that that was actually the same exact diner where Michael Mann brought the woman who was going to be his wife, Summer
yes.
Mann. And I think they were there for like 6 hours. I don't even know if they were dating yet. It was just, they're getting to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is like, I don't know, as a corny romantic, I just think
I
that's
love
so
that.
sweet.
Yeah.
That he basically is probably not replaying the same exact scene, but you know, choosing to,
yeah,
it's kind of a
it's
brave scene too, because
yeah.
it's like 10 minutes of dialogue.
Yes.
It's not contributing to a thriller kind of vibe. It's not pushing that forward. It's just like, we're just going to hang out with these guys for 10 minutes, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah, I think I'm just rambling at this point, but.
No, I think you're very, very astute. And I think that is what it is for sure. And it's something that Michael Mann does kind of replay throughout his career, with men bonding as well. He loves a good
oh,
diner.
Yeah.
Yeah. Throughout, something I love that's again in a lot of Michael Mann movies, and it goes for back to like him being a teenager and taking pictures in the streets of Chicago, is this idea of like being in this stuck in a maze, almost like a lid is over the city and you are constantly longing for the sea and the stars. I feel like the sea and the stars are these dreams that all of the characters have, like when they get to the water or when they look out at the sea. I mean, this is even in like Last of the Mohicans and stuff.
Yeah, that longing.
Yes. And it's just,
For...
he is one of our more romantic filmmakers. And I think a lot
Oh,
of
yeah.
people miss that. Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why a lot of women love him, because there is so much romance in his movies.
Yes.
But I wanted to say, like, oh, I know. You reminded me when you talk about the city as a maze and it feels like there's a lid on top. I
Yeah.
basically, I'm going to get political, unfortunately, which is another thing that I appreciate about this movie, is how for an American film in the 1980s, it is so radically left of
Oh,
center.
yeah.
It's basically saying that he's left one prison for another prison, and
Yes.
the second prison is capitalism. Like, I can't think of many movies that are more like anti-carceral and anti-capitalist than this
Yeah.
one. And just the city never feels, it does always feel like you said, like it's a box with a lid on it. Like it never feels like an open space until they're at the beach, and
Yes.
it feels like nothing could be more idyllic and open and free, and it feels like they've finally attained the American dream. I don't know. I really like that scene
I
as
love
well.
it.
There's no
Yeah.
scene that I don't like. I should stop saying I love that scene because it's implied, but
And
yeah.
the Tangerine Dream score, my gosh.
Ugh, beach. I think the song is called Beach Scene, which I
Yeah.
think is cute.
Yes.
And that feeling, I think they continue playing that score over the following scenes, like when they
Yes.
return home, and it still feels like
Very romantic.
nothing could
Yeah.
go wrong.
Yes. Which is when everything goes wrong.
Goes wrong, yes, of course.
Yes, cue shit hitting the fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you probably listened to the commentary, but maybe other people have not. But James Caan has a very beautiful way of describing the movie, which is like a minuet, where it goes from A, B, A. And so, like, there's A, and I think it's 8 bars, and B, which is 18 bars, and that's the bridge. But then it goes back to A.
That's right. Yeah,
so
it goes back.
He has to, like, return. Frank has to return to that original state of nihilism and not caring about anything. And that's kind of right about where that happens, if I remember right. Like, it's just starting to
make
go
that,
bad.
Make that switch again.
Yeah, that last, the final heist. And then, okay, I just watched this. I should remember. But yeah, I think that's right.
Yes. Yeah, it's a film that, yeah, I think we could do like a 3-hour podcast on, my gosh. But
I did want to say that I did realize this time watching it for the first time that, which maybe you think like, duh, Priscilla, but like the diner scene contrasted with the Leo scene in the bar. I didn't realize until this time how it's, I feel like, man constructed that scene to be like the cosmic opposite of the diner scene.
Yeah, very much.
Where he's basically making a deal with the devil to have a child. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah, it's eerie and like they're on one side of the booth and the way it's shot. Yeah.
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 Sorry, I think you were about to set us up for Night Moves, maybe? I'm not sure.
Oh,
where
no,
you're going.
Fine. Yeah, no, I was just going to say, but I do think it's interesting and it makes for a really good pairing with Night Moves, these films. Also, it's masculinity in this era, because Thief is exactly my age. It was a 1981 film. And then we have a film in the 70s here with Night Moves. I love what Gene Hackman was doing. And actually, I mean, as far back as Bonnie and Clyde, that is a performance that I think a lot of people forget with Gene. He was daring. I think he's one of those people who you talk about feral, and I think about Al Pacino, and I think about that's exactly how like Diane Keaton described him, is like he didn't know how to hold a fork, or he didn't know, like he was that wild. And this was the era of these really wild actors who just kind of swung for the fences and the wildness. And so I think Gene always made it look effortless. He would just sort of disappear in all of these roles. This was also, you know, Conversation is another film we both love. But yeah, so Night Moves, great Gene Hackman. It's a film I also love. You know, I just love the image of Gene in bed, like mostly naked,
with the fondue
after sex. He just looks so happy and just so free.
Green.
I love that. Yes.
I think the Conversation is probably his best performance, but this might be my favorite. And one of the things that I learned this week, preparing for this, is that the screenwriter is pretty sure, he didn't realize until after they were finished filming, but the screenwriter is pretty sure that Hackman, like, modeled his performance after him. Because, like, Alan Sharp had a mustache, so Hackman grew a mustache, and I think he copied some of his mannerisms. Mm-hmm. And I do think, I'm going to get this wrong, but I feel like I read somewhere that, I think maybe Alan Sharp did put some of himself into the screenplay, because there are certain lines that one of his ex-wives was like, Alan said that to me once or something.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can't help it, but I think with Sharp, it was like pretty obvious. Hackman must have discerned like, oh yeah, this is this fucking guy.
Yes, exactly. Oh my gosh, I love it. So which book did you read? And please,
okay. Oh yes, I should.
You are going to be the knowledgeable one on this one. I mean, my God. So I would love to know. Yeah.
Oh, my brain is trash, so I probably won't remember half of it. But it's called Mosby Confidential.
Ooh.
And I think Mosby. I'd want to make sure I get the guy's name right. I might pronounce it wrong. Matthew Asprey Gear.
Oh, yeah.
EAR. Yeah, yes. It's really good.
Oh, great.
It's a short read. I learned a lot. So thank you, Matthew.
Yeah. No, I'd love to know anything that you remember or learned. But I find it a really fascinating one because, I don't know, I love a good shaggy dog, private eye kind of thing. They're so messy. Like, mm-hmm. we hire these people to solve things, and usually they're, you know, following around people who are cheating on their spouses, and it's the least glamorous job ever. But I love, as you know, because we're Rockford File Columbo people, yeah. We love these characters and their messes, and Mosby's a mess. I think it's so good. He's, you know, struggling with his marriage. It's, you know, you got Melanie Griffith, it's one of those great LA movies where everybody is dark, like it's a sunshine noir where mm-hmm. the sun is drenched, but there's so much darkness lurking below the surface. So do you remember when you first saw it, your experience with it, or when it really started to become one of your favorites?
I think I watched it. I think it's been about a decade. It was okay. One of the Private Eye movies that I didn't really watch until later on. Like, I'd already seen Chinatown and The Long Goodbye and stuff, but Night Moves was kind of an 11th hour discovery. And I think it might be, it's among my favorite Private Eye movies. Like, it's something that I return to more than I do The Long Goodbye or Chinatown.
Gotcha.
But
have we ever talked about The Late Show?
I don't think so.
Oh my gosh. Write that one down.
Okay.
That might be, weirdly, I saw it, I think, during the pandemic for the first time. I don't know. I probably watched it 6 times by now.
I haven't seen that one.
Might Somebody be my else favorite.
Recommended that to me, but I can't remember who.
Okay.
I think it might have been one of our, I don't know if it was Jed.
It might have been Jed. Okay. Because we talked about it a lot with this episode we did on like terriers. You might have just heard me talk about it too much.
Yeah, I might have just absorbed it somewhere. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But Art Carney, Lily Tomlin. Oh my God. It's
maybe
Robert
you did.
Benton did it. Yeah. One of my faves. Yeah. And so when you were rattling those off, I was like, yeah, I love that. I love that. And then I'm like, where's The Late Show? Has she seen The Late Show?
I apologize. Yeah, I haven't seen everything, but
I'm so nerdy. Yeah. Zero in on these. Like, I get these, Krista Faust uses the phrase topic crushes. I get these film crushes like, oh, these all go together. Yes.
Yes. I mean, I just love anything Private Eye. Even this movie, which I feel is on a mission to subvert every single archetype, like Private Eye, I can't remember what, Dashiell Hammett has a phrase for like the missing girl case. I think he calls it like the wandering daughter case or something like that. But, you know, there's Deli and then there's like the wilting starlet and the femme fatale is Paula.
Yes.
And actually, I think she's the kernel that Sharp started with. He met a woman
Ooh,
who inspired Paula.
Okay.
Yeah, this is something I learned from the book. But he met a woman in the Keys. I think she was a drifter and maybe she was working at a bar. And she was dating some married guy who was not studly, as Alan Sharp put it. And she said something that stuck with him, which was actually almost exactly the same line in the movie, which is that, like everyone here drinks and he's the only guy who doesn't disimprove when he drinks.
Ooh, that's such a good line. Yes.
Yeah. And he actually says that he wished that he felt like Paula was really the protagonist of the story, but he made a commercial choice by making it the Private Eye. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I feel like all of the women in this movie, one of the things I like about it is that all the women in this movie they're smarter and more likable and more compelling than Mosby.
Yeah.
I mean, I love Mosby.
But they're terrible in interesting ways.
Yes.
Yeah. I think Paula as the protagonist would be fascinating. Oh my gosh. Like, especially if you would have started when she tells him like her backstory or like hints at it.
Yeah.
You want to ask like million questions about this person. But it's like, but you love the mystery. Like, she tells him about five things or four, I don't know how many things she tells him. It's a really weird scene. I think she realizes that she can use her sexuality as currency. And so I'm trying to actually count.
I think she's trying to distract him while, while Iverson is going, it's Iverson, right? He's going to hide the body or get rid of it.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
So she's, she's being the femme fatale, but she's also being a human being. Like, and I think what she confesses to him is real.
Oh yeah. And it just opens up. It's one of those things where you think it's an intimate moment, but when you're watching noir, you're like, oh, it also works. He should have paid closer attention there, but he's not the sharpest tool in the shed. My God. Yeah. and that's what's, interesting about him. Yes. Like, he is taken in by people that he shouldn't be, or he buys versions of events that without pushing back. Yes, that's good. Yeah, questioning.
And I think this is like the ultimate example of like the masculinity is a trap movie, because he buys into, I think the stunt guys remind him of football players.
Yeah,
and so he
absolutely.
Just automatically trusts them, you know, doesn't ever question Joey or what he might be up to, and immediately like just takes an instant disliking to characters like Quentin, because he's not a man's man, you know? He's just kind of like a hippie freak to him. But Mosby is, I think Alan Sharp actually wanted him to be worse, and Penn wanted to soften him up and make him more likable. So some of the...
Oh, interesting.
There's some stuff about him that's... And I actually kind of like... I like that he's kind of sympathetic. I feel bad for him, but...
Yeah, there's that great scene later on where he like breaks back into the house and where his wife is having a tryst, and he plays the music loud, and it's like a scene that, you know, I think if you were writing it today, it would have been a confrontation in a different way.
Yeah.
And I like that. It's just sad. It's a sad moment, just like when he sees her kiss somebody in a car, and there was like a vibe he got, an energy out of her walking out of, they say, Romer, and it drives me nuts, Romer film.
It's like watching paint dry.
Yes, watching paint dry. And he doesn't approach, and there's a sadness to Mosby for sure.
Well, he just keeps getting emasculated and
yes.
Cucked, yes. And I think it really bothers him that Marty is who he is.
Yeah.
You know, he's like this strong football player who's getting cucked by a man who's like shorter than him and softer and possibly maybe not more intelligent, but more sophisticated.
Definitely,
in a way that he dislikes.
Yeah, although the vanity plate on the car was really lame. Yeah. Some toy. Yeah, come on, guys.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not Marty's biggest fan either, but like, you can see that a guy like Mosby would look at a guy like Marty and be like,
oh yeah,
this fucking guy, you know?
Exactly. I love how that's your catchphrase for like this segment is this fucking guy. Yeah. This fucking guy. Come on.
Yeah. I don't mean to repeat myself, but yeah, like that's how many of these fucking guys.
Yeah. I think we both say that a little too much, so I love it. Yeah.
Where was I going with this? I don't know. I love that he is that type, because I do think the private eye is a masculine archetype and an ideal that I think is impossible to achieve, like the Humphrey Bogart, like Sam Spade or Marlowe. But you know, that's sort of the message of The Long Goodbye, is like, this guy is an anachronism. Like, he's a man out of time. He's especially considering, like, Sharp was writing the screenplay during Watergate, and it was like that era of really dark.
Yep.
I think it kind of starts with Clute. Maybe it starts a year prior, but these really dark movies coming out that kind of question like whether you can really make sense of anything.
And that's anyone who gets justice. Yep.
Yeah, Mosby ends up being this guy who thought he could solve this mystery, but he ends up, he's like his own case. You know, he's trying to solve, he wants to know what it's all about. And it's sort of this existential, like, he's trying to figure out who he is and what is going on in the universe. And by the end of it, he's literally going in circles.
Yeah, these were all post-Vietnam, essentially, this.
Yeah.
And distinctly American.
And post-assassinations, too.
I think it's really interesting that, like, you know, noir around post-war, post-World War, and we have it again, and we also have it when we're starting to question when we have people in government who have an enemies list, and when Watergate is happening. So we have these, like, portraits of really messy men ostensibly searching for the solution to a case, but really searching for what is going on in America and who escapes justice and who gets away. You know, did my friend kill his wife in Long Goodbye, or was I hired by somebody really nefarious, or what was going on in Night Moves?
Yeah, even the parallax view feels like it's kind of the same. It feels like the same thing to me, where it's like the journalist and the private eye are both these characters that are supposed to make sense of. Yeah, like what does Chandler say that he wrote in one of his letters? I think it was to the guy who wrote the Perry Mason novels, like his wife, Jane Bethel.
Okay.
He says something about how the private eye is the bringer of order out of chaos.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in the 70s, they started questioning whether there was any order or justice or truth that they could actually discern, or if everything was just, you know, like Paula says it, and then the end of the movie is this, where you're just sort of watching things happen out of your control underwater, you know.
Yeah, I mean, at its core, noir is extremely existential. And so that's once again what we have with Night Moves. And I also go for it. Yeah.
I wanted to say about Thief that I think the thing that's really interesting about Thief is that I feel like most noir and neo-noir, the fatalism feels very much like sourced from the universe itself or a character flaw in the protagonist. But with Thief, it's very much the system. Like, everything that's fatalistic about Thief feels like it's built into the way our country works.
Yeah,
and it's like all he has to do is make one little error in judgment. It's not that he's a bad guy. It's not that he's flawed. It's not the universe itself. It's the system we've constructed. Whereas Night Moves feels much more existential in that kind of like what's going on in the universe way, you know.
Yeah.
But I cut you off from saying something smart, I'm sure.
No, I think that's really good. Yeah. I do think, I mean, these are men who are the products of their environment and also their choices and who they trust and who they don't trust. And I think we all do that. We maybe trust the wrong people, and hopefully you know, and the system works for us, it works against us. Hopefully we don't end up in these predicaments that we're watching in these films, of course, but you know, they're really great films. I wish we made more movies with characters as complicated and messy as the women in Night Moves. And
even
Jesse. I wish I knew more about Jesse. That's my one thing, but
yeah.
Oh my God, I love Thief, and I love all these actors and these characters. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. Jen, of course.
Yeah.
And I think they would actually make a really good double feature.
Yes, for sure.
I don't know. And they both have, I don't know if this is like revealing too much about myself, but I love a feel-good movie with like a happy ending, but there's something about both of these movies where they're just so bleak and the endings are so tragic and grim that it almost has this weird, like, it almost gives me like a weird body high. have you experienced this where you're like, sometimes like things are so bleak that it almost makes you a little euphoric? You're like, oh shit, like I can't believe. No, is this not relatable to you at all?
I think because it's beautiful and because you relate to the characters and you maybe you feel like you went on that journey with them and you've experienced some of these feelings and you've gone through it, maybe? You think that's part of it?
I think it's like probably cathartic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of almost like watching a horror movie where by the ending it's just so crazy. You're like, oh, fuck. Like, but it gives you, you have like a physical response to it that is not necessarily negative. And I do think I kind of relate to Frank, which is maybe, I would say my two favorite movies that are tied are like The Piano and Thief. And I feel like it's because I relate to both of those characters. And Frank especially.
How are they tied together?
Oh, to me, emotionally.
Oh,
they're like
okay.
Tied for my number one favorite movie.
Oh my God, that's so funny. I was like looking for a thread. I'm like,
no.
And Frank? Like,
no, I feel like maybe it's like feminine masculine sides or something. Ooh, I don't know how to explain it, but
We need to do a double feature, I guess. Come on, Vidiots. Somebody. Yes. Let's get this going.
I think we're probably the only two people who would be like on board for both, but.
I love it. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. There's something about
God, I
Frank's
love
universe and just sort of feeling like, huh?
I said, God, I love The Piano. Now I want to watch that too.
You should watch it. Yeah. People should always be watching The Piano. I don't really talk about it that much online because I'm very protective of it.
Oh.
But I don't know. There's something about Frank's predicament, which I'm like, oh, that is what life feels like, which is probably revealing too much about myself. But it does. I don't know. It just feels like, you can relate to Frank, even if you haven't been in the system.
Yeah. And I mean, self-employed. Hello. That's our money.
Exactly. I love that he's a Marxist. And when he says like, you know, I can see my money is in your pocket, which is the yield of my labor. That's like, I think that's one of Marx's theories of labor. So it's like,
you probably read that inside.
In prison, sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure you have listened to the commentary, but Khan and Mann both talk about, like, they talk about prisoners with such compassion. And they talk about how Frank, you know, they have a whole backstory for him that is mm-hmm. largely influenced by the real Khan's. I mean, that set is like half criminal, half cop.
Yeah.
Which, like, I think if I could choose one set to be on and time travel, that would be the set that I would want to be a part of. Because have you heard the stories? Like, I know Belushi
talks.
We could
hang out with Baby Rob. Yeah. Oh, wait, that was before. Well,
Wasn't it like, it was like, I think Belushi's wife was pregnant.
Oh,
or they
yeah.
were about to get
okay.
married.
Yeah.
And when she was pregnant.
Yeah. So we couldn't hang out
We couldn't catch Rob, but I think they would have cops and criminals like
mm-hmm.
kind of giving each other shit, and like one criminal would admit like, oh, that was me who did that robbery, but the statute of limitations was up, and then like you'd have Dennis Farina being like, oh yeah, I know, but I let you go on that one or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm just rambling at this point, but
no, great movies.
Yeah.
To be a fly on the wall. With Harry and also in Chicago with pre-baby Rob. Yes. Yeah. We're going to weird out Rob completely when he hears this. It's going to be amazing. Yes. Priscilla, thank you so much for doing this. Come back. You got to come for an entire episode so we can just get weird and say
I'm
this
game.
Fucking guy all the time. And it'll be fun.
It's been a pleasure and an honor, Jen. Thank you.
Same. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.